You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
200 years before Jesus was born, the descendants of Alexander the Great's army invaded and took total control of Judea, imposing Greek culture on the whole populace. And in an effort to maintain their influence in this new Greek order, the elite Jewish aristocracy abandoned their Jewish practices and morals and were what's called Hellenized, or absorbed into the Greek way of doing things. About 35 years later, one family finally had had enough, and they organized a rebel army. The guerrilla war that ensued eventually spelled defeat for what was called the Hellenistic Seleucid dynasty. Because these Jewish rebels were so ferocious, they were called the Maccabees, which means the hammer in Hebrew. Their bravery was legendary, fighting against even wine-crazed, battle-trained elephants. In 164 before the Common Era, Jerusalem was recaptured by the Maccabees, and the temple was purified. This is an event that is memorialized to this day in the holiday of Hanukkah. You can find the whole story in the apocryphal books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees. Our passage today, though, is taken from a book called 4th Maccabees. It's less history than it is a sermon praising the virtues of the Jewish way of doing things. While you won't find it in your Protestant Bible, it's in both Greek and some Orthodox Bibles. While it is regarded as Jewish literature from a Jewish perspective, it was originally written in Greek, probably by a Jew living in the cosmopolitan city of Alexandria, Egypt. Just the kind of place where the Maccabean spirit of promoting Jewish piety would have been very important.
Our words of wisdom are from 4th Maccabees, chapter 1, verses 15 through 17, and chapter 2, verses 6b and 8.
Clear thinking comes from the mind and leads to wisdom, which is knowledge about God and people, and about why things happen the way they do.
We become wise by obeying the law of Moses, because in it, God tells us how he wants us to live. Clear thinking also keeps us from being selfish and unfair.
Even greedy people who start obeying God's law will stop their selfish ways. They will agree to lend money to those in need without charging interest, and after 6 years will not ask them to pay it back.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Ever hear of the Rosetta Stone? Not the language software, but the original chunk of rock that the software is named for. As part of the French occupation of Egypt, fortifications were being dug at a place called Rosetta, and one of Napoleon's dragoons came across a 4-foot by 3-foot slab of granite, on which was carved an inscription from 196 before the Common Era. So in 1799, it was already 2,000 years old. But the age wasn't what made the stone remarkable. What made it remarkable was the fact that the inscription was written in 3 different languages: Egyptian hieroglyphics, Egyptian cursive, and ancient Greek. To this point, nobody had been able to crack Egyptian hieroglyphics. And behold, here was the magic decoder slab. Using the ancient Greek as a guide, Egyptologists were finally able to definitively translate the 2 Egyptian scripts. Now, even if you know the significance of the Rosetta Stone in the history of, well, history, do you know what it actually says? It's about the new ruler of Egypt apportioning justice or fair treatment to all through, wait for it, the forgiveness of debts. Now let's rewind another 1,500 years to Babylon and the Code of Hammurabi. Yet another slab, it is inscribed with the expectations of the sun god, including the mandate that in order to protect widows and orphans and declare justice in the land, that the strong not injure the weak. Sounding familiar? One way this is to be achieved is a very early version of limited liability law. If I have a debt and sell myself or my wife or children into forced labor, 3 years is the limit of service after which I or they shall be set free. The legal codes of the Torah continued in this tradition. Release from tax and debt, interest and slavery, and special concern for the widows, orphans, and immigrants among us. So why forgive our debts? Because in biblical times, debt, slavery, and slavery for debt are major concerns. And before you dismiss this as an ancient problem disconnected from the contemporary experience, consider the reality of what John Dominic Crossan calls neo-slavery today. Outright slavery may be forbidden, but excessive debt is a very effective method of owning or controlling both individuals and nations. The Bible warns us, interest fees or pledges, collateral, are a precursor to slavery. So the Torah outright forbids it, at least to neighbors and resident aliens. You can charge foreigners, but not neighbors. And it goes further and proclaims the virtue of a Sabbath year, set forth by God in Exodus, Deuteronomy, and other texts. It decrees that all slaves who have served for 6 years are to be set free, and all debts will be canceled. Our Maccabees passage calls the charging of interest and keeping people in slavery greed, plain and simple. It acknowledges that the love of money is natural, but if you adopt a way of life in accordance with God's will, you'll overcome those base instincts and not only lend without interest, but cancel all debts when the seventh year arrives. Part of the challenge for modern American Christians is that this kind of talk is seen as just a bunch of biblical falderal. When you get right down to it, capitalism, especially Ayn Rand-inspired libertarianism, celebrates greed as a virtue. Greed is seen as a necessary and positive force driving the entrepreneurial spirit and the growth of the economy. Leveraging OPM, other people's money, debt, and interest is at the heart of our system. Can you imagine suggesting to Wall Street that charging interest is a bad thing? Who says? God? So, is this all just aspirational, realistic, hopeful, pie in the sky? Some of you know Bono as the leader of God's favorite band, U2. But are you also aware that Fortune magazine has repeatedly named Bono as one of the world's 50 greatest leaders? Why? Because of his work to relieve developing countries from crushing debt and modern-day slavery. Almost 25 years ago now, world leaders were challenged to usher in the millennium by forgiving the debts of the poorest countries on the planet. It was called the Global Jubilee 2000 Initiative. And that was Bono. He started out just trying to raise the money. And through his Live Aid concert, you might remember, he raised $125 million in one show. But sadly, $125 million was less than what African countries were paying in interest alone every day. It was clear that no amount of showy benefit concerts would ever solve the problem. But forgiving the debt would, by freeing up resources that could be used for education, infrastructure, healthcare, and so much more. As a Christian, Bono was inspired by the biblical decree called the Jubilee Year, that every 50 years, debts should be forgiven and slaves freed. Moved by this possibility, he worked tirelessly to convince banks and world leaders that something needed to change. The inertia of their unexamined business-as-usual greed was enslaving whole continents full of people. Now, according to the World Bank, the campaign led to the cancellation of more than $100 billion of debt owed by 35 of the globe's poorest countries. A jubilee indeed. Crossan suggests that, far from being a metaphor, when the Lord's Prayer is prayed within the biblical matrix of interest-free loans and debt forgiveness, "Forgive us our debts as we have forgiven our debtors," is literal. Unfortunately, many, maybe most, Christians reciting the Lord's Prayer take this idea of debts or trespasses metaphorically. The line is, hey, debts means sins, and we're asking God to forgive us our sins as we forgive those who sin against us, right? Well, not exactly. What did Jesus actually intend? And what were the gospel writers trying to get across? If you look at the Greek word Matthew uses for debt, ophilime, it's pretty clear. What Jesus is talking about is financial debt, that which is owed, legally due. In regular usage, it means to owe money, period. But when you compare Mark to Matthew to Luke, the words change. Debts changes to trespasses, and then in pretty short order, to sins. So even the gospel writers were leaving things open to interpretation. In the end, it may be best to consider debt, trespass, and sin, not debt alone or sin alone, and not sin instead of debt. Crossan concludes that originally, debts was probably intended quite literally. Jesus literally meant enough bread for today and no debt for tomorrow. Tim Comfer of Sojourners Magazine writes, "Many of those who responded with excitement to Jesus' message had basically become slaves through the deceptive system of debt bondage, sharecroppers on their family land, whose wealth went to enrich absentee landlords. One bad year could lead these Judean and Galilean peasants to become trapped in intractable cycles of debt, struggling just to feed and clothe themselves. The little money they made to provide for their needs was further whittled down by the heavy taxation policies of the Roman Empire." When Jesus urged his disciples to forgive us our debts as we forgive others, he did so out of the direct experience that debt was, and I'd say still is, a primary tool of social control, even a kind of slavery. Jesus invited his followers to return to the idea of debt forgiveness taught in the Law of Moses, practicing community and forgiveness, not competition and retribution. So, the challenge for us today is to consider the interactions of debt, trespasses, and sin. In the biblical tradition, when the practice of predatory debt creates inequality, it becomes sinful. When a system is based on taking financial advantage of the poor and uneducated, it becomes immoral. But if you're thinking, "Phew, I don't lend money, so this one obviously doesn't apply to me," think again. There's one more angle to ponder. In Matthew's version, it's, "Forgive us our debts or sins as we have forgiven." At least for Matthew, this is not just about money, and it's not a comparison, but a condition. God will forgive only if we forgive. Paraphrasing Everett Fulham, a Baptist, "Forgive us our debts or sins only to the extent that we are willing to forgive those who owe us or who have sinned against us." Yikes! If we refuse to forgive, then this part of the Lord's Prayer becomes a curse. We are essentially praying, "Deal with me as I deal with my neighbor." Uh-oh, for many of us, that might be pretty harsh. Episcopal priest Andy Doyle suggests that the reduction of the gospel to forgiveness of sins misses the point of the gospel, which is about making people whole. And how are people made whole? Through relationships, and not with just folks you like and who like you, but as civilizations from Hammurabi through the Rosetta Stone period to the Torah to Jesus, all have made it clear. Wholeness comes through compassionate relationships with the downtrodden among us, widow, orphan, and immigrant. Sin is not about breaking a rule, but about falling short in kindness, love, empathy, and generosity. It's about resisting the culturally approved practice of taking advantage of people who are trapped or disadvantaged by the realities of a system they have little to no control over. Our Maccabees passage says that clear thinking keeps us from being selfish and unfair. And even greedy people who start obeying God's law will stop their selfish ways. They will agree to lend money to those in need without charging interest, and after 6 years, will not ask them to pay it back. Impossible? Romantic? Utopian nonsense? Maybe so. But that was Jesus. Ha! What a kidder! How about we just head out today remembering that it's more important to believe in Jesus rather than actually doing anything that he suggested we do, right? That's so much easier. I mean, what a relief, right? I mean, this kingdom of God thing is better just left as a pie-in-the-sky aspirational thing, right? Back in 1966, Robert Kennedy was invited to speak to students living under the apartheid regime in South Africa. For inviting him, Ian Robertson, a student at the University of Cape Town, received a banning order from the government, essentially put under house arrest. Despite all the controversy, 18,000 students and faculty gathered to hear Kennedy speak. Some believe there is nothing one man or one woman can do against the enormous array of the world's ills. Yet many of the world's great movements of thought and action have flowed from the work of a single person. It is from numberless diverse acts of courage and belief that human history is shaped. Each time a person stands up for an ideal, or acts to improve the lot of others, or strikes out against injustice, he or she sends forth a tiny ripple of hope. and crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, those ripples build a current that can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance. Forgive us our debts as we forgive others. Is it literal financial debt? Yes. Is it metaphorical trespasses? Yes. Is it relational and spiritual sin? Yes. Will the efforts of one person make a difference? Yes. But it won't be easy. As Kennedy finished his speech, few are willing to brave the disapproval of their fellows, the censure of their colleagues, the wrath of their society. Moral courage is a rarer commodity than bravery in battle or great intelligence. Yet it is the one essential, vital quality for those who seek to change a world that yields most painfully to change. So, forgive us our debts, Lord. And don't forget, next time you say the Lord's Prayer, you're asking God to deal with you as you deal with your neighbor. Good luck with that. Be well. Don't forget, if you liked what you heard today, buy me a coffee. The link's in the description.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.